Chapter 2. Why Giving Makes Us Happy. Some years ago, I was called to the little town of Verdon, Illinois, to raise money for a church building. They had to move to a new location in order to expand and needed $50,000 to get started. The future growth of their church depended on the success of this venture. On Sunday morning, I spoke to the congregation about giving and had just started to take commitments when a young man stood up and asked to speak. He said, "My wife and I have been up most of the night praying, and God has definitely spoken to us about what we should do. We just sold our house," he continued, "and had $10,000 equity. We plan to buy another home and use the extra money as a down payment. God spoke to both of us and said, 'You can do better by giving the $10,000 to the church and renting for a while.'" The young man's offer was shocking, to say the least, but God had obviously dealt with his couple. I would never have suggested to anyone that they make such a bold offer. In fact, his decision appeared to be a very unwise thing to do. I also knew, however, that making a substantial gift of at least 10% of the total amount needed and doing it openly often ensures the success of a fundraising venture. Who was I to argue with God's methods? Some months later, I met the pastor of the Verdon Church at a national meeting and asked him, "What happened to that young deacon and his wife who gave their down payment on a house to the building program?" Smiling, he answered, "Brother Clark, you'd never guess what happened. About a month after they had given their money to the church, another local couple had to vacate their house in order to relocate to take a better job. They had no time to put their house on the market, so they offered it to our deacon and his wife if they would just take over the mortgage payments with no money down." "That's wonderful," I replied, relieved to know God had blessed them. "But there's more," the pastor continued. "The house was new, and the mortgage was less than our couple had planned to pay for an older home. They have moved in and are very happy." This couple did what looked like a foolish thing, but look at the end result. Blessing above anything they could ask or think. They have a better home than they could have bought, and Verdon has a new church. The happy, cheerful giver. Anyone who raises money must be a giver himself. He must also be convinced that it doesn't ever hurt anyone, including himself, to obey God in giving if he is sure of God's leading. Once that truth is settled in the leader's heart and mind, he will not have to bluster and threaten or tell people how much they should give. He will not have to oversell. The leader can relax and let God and the people work it out. The fundraiser's main job is to get God and the people together working on the problem. I have learned a lot from 2 Corinthians 9. In this chapter, the Apostle Paul is raising money for the famine sufferers in Judea, and all the churches under his care are being asked to make a special fund drive for this cause. In verse 7, Paul says, "Every man according as he purposeth in his heart, so let him give, not grudgingly or of necessity, for God loveth a cheerful giver." Let's look at the four parts of this verse. 1. Every man according as he purposeth in his heart, so let him give. Let God deal with each man as to what amount he is to give. 2. Not grudgingly. This would suggest that the person has been crowded into giving and that his heart is not in it. 3. Or of necessity. This again indicates that the person is being pushed because of the urgency of the need. And 4. God loveth a cheerful giver. The word used here, cheerful, is translated from the word hilaros, which really means hilarious, or, as I like to think of it, happy enthusiastic, and spontaneous. How can you be cheerful and give away your hard-earned money at the same time? This is a good question. The answer is in verse 6. But this I say, he which soweth sparingly shall reap also sparingly, and he which soweth bountifully shall reap also bountifully. Here Paul likens giving to God, or to the poor in this case, as sowing. We all know that the reaping is far greater than the sowing. Jesus spoke of the sower whose seed brought forth some 100, and some 60, and some 30-fold. See Matthew 13:23. This is about what a farmer would expect to reap, about 30 times more than the original amount of seed. Or it could be 60 times what he sowed, or even 100 times as much when the crop is harvested. Paul says we will reap according to how much we sow. The entire chapter of 2 Corinthians 9 is filled with promises to the giver. There is not one threat. There is not one line to make people feel guilty. All I see here are promises of blessing. Those who give can feel happy because God's work is being done. At the same time, we can be assured that God will reward us for what we do for Him and His cause. Those in need also will rejoice because God's people have been generous in helping them. Paul compliments the people. He doesn't rail at them. The Apostle Paul teaches us several important principles in these verses. 1. Giving is learned. 2. People can only give happily according to their faith. 3. Good things happen to those who obey God in their giving. 4. Many times the givers become the key to victory in a situation, especially if they give openly. And 5. Example is a tremendous force in anything we do for God. The giver is doing God's work, and God is rewarding him for it. Over the years, I have seen God do miracles for those who are happy givers. The Spirit of Giving. Some years ago, I was invited to be the morning and night speaker at a pastor's conference in West Texas. A prominent pastor of a Texas church was one of the day speakers, and he mentioned to me that he and his wife were getting ready to return to the mission field. "We've announced our decision, but have not resigned our pastorate as yet," he told me. "In the months to come, we will be raising our support to go overseas as missionaries." I held that thought in the back of my mind. That same day, the district youth leader asked me to go to lunch with him. "The youth department has gone into the red about $30,000, he said. "I wondered if you could give me some ideas to bring it in line." I didn't seem to be able to give him much help, but told him I would think about it. That night at the pastor's conference, I felt strongly led to speak on the topic of giving. As I was speaking, I felt a spirit of giving sweep over the audience. I knew the people were ready to give, but I was at a loss as to what to do. The district superintendent had not given me any permission to take an offering. If I did take an offering, I felt there were two needs to consider: the couple going to the mission field and the need in the youth department. While still in the pulpit, I prayed silently and could not get an answer as just what to do at the close of my message. So I finished and sat down. The district superintendent started singing a chorus. About halfway through the song, a young man started walking down the aisle and up to the platform. He whispered something to the superintendent and then went to the pulpit. As the young man started to speak, he was overcome with emotion and began to weep. When he could finally talk, he told of his deep burden for the youth department and the financial need. Then he said, God has burdened me to give $1,000 toward this need. Immediately, a beautiful spirit of worship and a broken spirit swept the audience. Other people began to stand up and make commitments to the youth department. This kept up for perhaps 20 minutes. When they were through, the pastors had committed approximately $30,000. Nobody asked for money, but somebody had been praying, and God supplied the need. God didn't need my help, so He just didn't tell me anything. Thank God I didn't try to do something myself. I obeyed God by speaking on giving, and God took care of the rest. There is more to this story, however. When opportunity knocks. While I was working on this book, I got a telephone call. The voice at the other end of the line said, "This is John Murdoch, the young man who went to the platform the night you preached on giving at the pastor's conference in West Texas. I started the giving that netted $30,000 for the youth department." "Yes," I replied, "I remember you well. You were voted in as district youth leader the next year when the other man resigned the office." "That's right," he said. "The Lord changed my life when I stepped out in faith to give. That was the greatest night of my life." John then asked if he could come up and talk with me, which he did about a week later. "Our daughter attends Southwestern College in Texas," he explained, "and they need a new building very badly. I am interested in helping them raise the money to build the building." I made a few suggestions and sent some material home with him outlining the best ways to raise that kind of money. Months passed, and I hadn't heard from him. In October 1994, about the same time I was thinking of contacting John to find out what had happened, he called me. I could tell from his voice he was on cloud nine as he explained what had happened. At first, I talked to the college committee and suggested we begin by raising $100,000 from the alumni, he told me. But no one gave me the go-ahead to do anything about it, so for a while, all I could do was wait. "One man was sold on my ideas," John continued, "and he was in charge of one of the fundraising meetings for the new building. During the meeting, he asked me to come up to the platform and pray. He told me, 'If you want to say something, feel free to do so.' I knew that was my opportunity." John told the people that the college had asked the alumni to raise the first $100,000. He said, "My wife and I have prayed about it and feel that God is leading us to pledge $5,000 toward the construction of the new building. Now I'm going to pray and ask God to let you know if you are to have a part in giving toward this $100,000, and if so, how much." John said when he prayed, he felt the Spirit of God move over the congregation. People began to raise their hands and tell how much they would give. "I remembered you had told me to keep track of how much was given," John explained. "So I asked someone to add up the pledges as they came in." When this process seemed to be taking a long time, John asked the congregation if they wanted to stop, and everyone shouted, "No, no, don't stop." When the total got to $77,000, John started counting down, telling the people, "Now we only have $23,000 to go." Then, when they got up past $90,000, a man came to the platform with a check for $10,000. At that point, John told the people, "We have to stop, folks. We have over $100,000. John told me, "Everyone involved is excited and believing we can raise the total amount needed for the new building for the college." What were the key factors that led to John's fundraising success? First, John prayed about what he himself was to give until he got an answer from God. Second, John was bold about publicly acknowledging his pledge when the opportunity presented itself. Third, John counted the money as it came in. And fourth, He never urged people to give. He simply invited them to join him in giving. Obedience wins a victory. Several years ago, our good friend, Dr. Richard Dobbins, a clinical psychologist living in Akron, Ohio, asked Estella and me to have lunch with him when he was here in Springfield. Dr. Dobbins mentioned that his national ministry, Emerge, was having their annual dinner meeting in November in conjunction with their yearly board meeting. This has always been a time to raise money for our work, he explained to us. I'm especially excited about this year's banquet since a businessman in the East has promised to give $250,000 if we can raise $500,000 that night. That's wonderful, I exclaimed, wondering why he was telling me this. Since I had previously worked for him as a consultant for almost 2 years, I could tell Dr. Dobbins had something more on his mind. Would you be willing to come and raise the money in that meeting? He asked. If we can make our goal, it would be possible for us to build a headquarters building, which we desperately need. I thought for a moment, knowing that Estella and I had pledged all we should for that year. I felt we couldn't give a substantial amount. We can't give very much ourselves, I told Dr. Dobbins, perhaps a token gift of $1,000. That's fine, he replied. No, I said, I think that whoever raises that money should be someone who can give a very substantial amount. I really want you to be the one to raise the money for us, he urged, asking us to do it anyway. I couldn't turn down a man like Dr. Dobbins. He was doing too great a work, and besides, we loved him like family. I will do my best, I said. Then I asked, how many people will be there? About 150. My faith level suddenly dropped. I knew I didn't have the faith to believe that we could raise $500,000 with so few in attendance. The day of the banquet, I arrived in Akron and checked into my motel room early. As I was kneeling by the bedside praying, I told God, I don't have the faith for $500,000, and Estella and I have pledged all that is prudent for us this year. But if you let me know that we should give more anyway, Lord, you know I will do it. The Lord made it very clear to me that we should pledge $10,000. I agreed to do it, but my faith for the $500,000 was still lacking. After dinner that night, I stepped to the podium and looked out at the 150 people attending the banquet. I simply told them about the tremendous need for the building and how much depended on our raising $500,000. We then passed out pledge cards. I told the audience about my experience in the motel room that afternoon. The Lord has told me to give $10,000, I said. Then I prayed that God would lead the people as to what they should give. Just write your name and the amount on the pledge card, and the ushers will bring them up, I instructed, trying to sound encouraging. As the cards were brought up, I read the amounts while an accountant added them on his calculator. When I asked for the first subtotal, it was $212,000. Well, I thought, that's probably all we'll get. But the ushers kept bringing up more and more pledge cards. The next subtotal was $316,000. This has to be close to the end, I thought. But the cards kept coming. The next subtotal was $416,000. It was not until then that I felt a tiny spark of faith. Maybe we can reach the $500,000 goal, I said to myself. I didn't ask for another subtotal until all the cards were collected. It was $575,000. But that was not the end. Late pledges brought the total to $700,000. Later, I was able to evaluate why this fundraising event was so successful. 1. Dale Burkey, Dr. Dobbins' consultant, had done a great job planning before the meeting ever took place. too. Dr. Dobbins and his staff had led in the giving, and others had made advanced commitments. And three, my obeying God could have been another key to the success. I don't know. I'm sure it didn't hinder. Today, Emerge Ministries has a beautiful headquarters building, and the pledge Estella and I made was paid very easily. In fact, I feel that we prospered because of our giving. When God asks you to do something, it is never hard to do. He always provides a way and leaves more than He takes. Give until it hurts. One day, while I was waiting to address a district council meeting, I was sitting in an adjoining room as the Vespers service was coming to a close. The young man who was speaking raised his voice and said with considerable authority, "If you haven't given till it hurts, you haven't given." I am sure that the young man was sincere, but I am afraid he was quoting some preacher who was mistaken. This statement has caused a lot of people to feel guilty because their giving did not hurt them in any way, and they have been told that it should hurt them to give. In the Gospel of Luke, Jesus says, "Give, and it shall be given unto you, good measure, pressed down, and shaken together, and running over, shall men give into your bosom. For with the same measure that ye measure out, withal it shall be measured unto you again." Luke 6:38. This is in the present continuous tense. As long as I keep giving, this is going to keep happening. It shall be given back to me, good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over. And with whatever measure I use in my giving, this same measure shall be used to give back to me. When that happens, it will be good measure, pressed down, and shaken together, and running over. And the bigger the measure I use to give, the bigger the measure used for my returns. This being the case, how could it ever hurt me to obey God in my giving? Some people will say immediately, "Yes, but it depends on your motive." Jesus just said, "Give and it shall be given unto you." He gave no other conditions to this promise. I think I can safely believe what Jesus said is true. If God has helped me to build a prosperous business so that I can give regularly to His work, is it reasonable to believe that He would ask me to give so much that it would cripple the very business He had helped me to build? Then I would not be able to give at all. To whom was Jesus speaking when He said, "Give, and it shall be given unto you"? Before Him was a multitude of the sick, lame, halt, and blind. In fact, the Bible says, "The common people heard him gladly." Mark 12:37. When John the Baptist got discouraged in prison, he sent some of his disciples to Jesus to ask, "Are you the one that was to come, or do we look for another?" Jesus' answer was not a yes or no. Instead, he said, "Go and show John again those things which ye do hear and see. The blind receive their sight, and the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear, the dead are raised up, and the poor have the gospel preached to them." Matthew 11:4-5. I think we could assume that most of this multitude were poor people. If giving would simply make people poorer, and if it was not true that giving would come back to us good measure pressed down and shaken together and running over, to speak such a thing to all these poor people would have been cruel, to say the least. Jesus came to help people. To a multitude of poor people, he said, "Give, and it shall be given unto you, good measure, pressed down and shaken together and running over, shall men give into your bosom. For with the same measure that ye measure out, withal, or in every circumstance, it shall be measured to you again." I believe Jesus was saying, You start giving, and you'll find it coming back to you even in greater measure than you gave. God's surprise. While I was president of the Bible College in Minneapolis, Richard Dortch, who was the Illinois district superintendent at the time, asked me to serve as interim minister of the Stone Church in Chicago. The congregation had no pastor at the time, so for 9 weeks I flew down on weekends to preach. The church had just finished a new building but had not started to make monthly payments on the construction loan since the closing had not yet taken place. At over $12,000 a month, the congregation was not financially prepared to make that kind of payment. The church board asked me to raise the money since I had done a lot of this kind of work anyway. On Commitment Sunday, I spoke on giving and then prayed that God would let people know what they should pledge on the building. The pledge was to be paid over 1 year's time. Cards were passed out and I asked them to write their name and the amount they felt God would have them give. After the ushers collected the cards and brought them up to me, I read the amounts aloud while a deacon added the amounts. Although I seldom take note of the name on a card, I did notice Phil and Vicki Epperson's name on a pledge card for $10,000. At the time, Phil was the visitation pastor and had been in that position with the church for 2 years. He had 4 children and received a yearly salary of $21,500. I knew very well that Phil and Vicki could not afford to give $10,000, but I knew also that Phil and Vicki had a close relationship with the Lord. They wouldn't put $10,000 on a pledge card unless God had definitely led them to do it, I told myself. After a successful fund drive to meet the monthly building loan payments, it came time for the church leaders to begin looking for a new pastor. As we considered the kind of man the church needed, the board decided it had to be someone with years of experience, successful, and seasoned, everything a large church like that would want in a pastor. To my surprise, after meeting and hearing the first candidate preach, the congregation didn't vote him in as the new pastor. Then I began to hear people saying, "Why can't Phil be our pastor?" Or, "What's the matter with having Phil and Vicki as pastors?" Phil and Vicki were as surprised as anyone about the sudden interest in them. They certainly weren't expecting to assume such a responsible position. I thought Phil was too young. "He's only been in the ministry 2 years and hasn't preached very much," I remarked. They said, "Yes, but through his counseling, he has brought 200 people into the church who have become members in the last 2 years." I told the church board, "We should vote on Phil before putting up any more names. I don't think the people will vote anyone else in until they vote on Phil Epperson." A business meeting was promptly announced to vote on Phil as pastor. When the time came, it was almost unanimous. There may have been one no vote. I don't remember for sure. Phil and Vicki have been pastoring the Stone Church in Chicago since the mid-1970s. Things are going great, and God has used them in a wonderful way. Their starting salary as pastor was double what they were getting when they made the $10,000 pledge. You see, they knew God, and God knew they would be able to pay the $10,000. You just can't get hurt obeying God. Asking the right question. Young couples, both beaming, used to come into my office at the college. He wanting to tell me how they met, she wanting to show me the diamond. I have always enjoyed talking to people who are in love, probably because I'm still in love myself. Somewhere in the conversation, I usually asked when the happy event would take place. The answer so many times was 1 year, 2 years, or 3 years. When I asked why they were waiting so long, the answer usually was, We can't afford to do it any sooner. I've always thought that two could live cheaper than one, especially if they both work. Then, too, I thought of a little rhyme I heard somewhere. The bride, bent with years, leaned over her cane. Her steps, now feeble, need guiding. While down the church aisle, with a wan, toothless smile, the groom in a wheelchair gliding. Now who is this elderly couple thus wed? You'll find, when you've closely explored it, that this is that rare conservative pair who waited till they could afford it. What can I afford is not the right question to ask. I have talked with millionaires who said they couldn't afford to give, and they really believed it. The right question to ask when any legitimate need is presented is, what does God want to channel through me? Asking the right questions always helps me to give happily and enthusiastically. Sometimes we raise money for special projects at church and call it Miracle Sunday. But what size is a miracle? If our giving is a miracle, it could just as easily be a big miracle as a little one, as far as God is concerned. If God lays it on your heart to make a commitment for more money than you have or than you could get, and you are very sure that it is God speaking to you, then you can safely make the commitment, knowing God will supply the money to pay it. There is a secret, however, to this kind of giving. After Estella and I make a pledge, we begin to pay on it as soon as God starts supplying the money to us. As a result, we have never had trouble paying a pledge. That is my advice to all givers. Pay your pledge immediately. Don't wait to get it all. Start sowing as soon as God supplies the seed. Get it into God's hands as soon as possible. Why? Because the sooner God gets it, the sooner the harvest will begin. When I was working with Capital Ministries, we were raising money for a church building in Denver, Colorado. During the fundraising, an elderly widow pledged $5,000. The pastor told her no one expected her to do this and that it was too large a pledge for someone of her limited means. She said with a smile, "Look, I know my limitations, but I also know God. The Lord impressed me definitely to pledge this amount, and I know that He will provide the money for me to pay it." I have learned that people can only give happily according to their faith, and this dear widow was happy knowing she was obeying God. 2 weeks later, this lady received a telephone call from a man who was a total stranger to her. He said, "We are a new company just moving into Denver. We like your telephone number and are prepared to pay you $3,000 for it." She had never heard of anything like this, so she called the telephone company. They told her that this was a common practice. This dear lady knew God's voice, and I'm sure He met the rest of her need. Her one act of obedience had a great effect on the entire congregation in that Capital Fund campaign. In fact, she was probably the key to success in raising the money for the new building. You see, God has 1,000 ways to meet your needs and mine, so there is no good reason not to trust Him when you know you are obeying His voice. God always does something special for the happy giver. So what do we have to lose?